On Tech News Today, Apple and Intel refused to fund patent trolling this time around, but Microsoft and Sony are all in. Most Twitter users never or almost never send a tweet, and Amazon is getting into the comic book business. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, April 11th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day in conversation with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor this week is Natalie Morris, a contributor to NBC and co-founder of ReadQuick, a speed reading app for iOS. Welcome, Natalie.
Thank you. Good to be back. Let's do some news.
Glad you're back. Well, yes, that's a great idea. We're here. The industry's biggest patent troll intellectual ventures got Microsoft and Sony to invest in its latest acquisition of patents, by the way, but failed to get Apple and Intel, according to an exclusive posted this morning by Reuters. Now, this is a little understood and poorly reported aspect, Natalie, of the whole patent troll phenomenon. Because essentially, the big companies that often claim to be victims of patent trolls, in fact, invest in patent trolling companies, especially intellectual ventures. Intellectual Ventures is by far the biggest patent troll company. And before we get into this conversation, just to define what a patent troll is, the difference between a patent troll and a company that people might accuse of being a patent troll is that patent troll companies have no intention of using the patents they purchase to actually build or sell products. They buy
so it's
them.
Not like an incubator, whereas they actually exactly. are coming up with things that they intend to implement. They're just sort of middleman.
Exactly. They're looking to make money from the patent, so they have intellectual property. Somebody is using something similar, so they sue that company. They usually settle out of court. They get a settlement, and that's their income and their revenue. So this is really fascinating because you might think, well, of course, Apple and Intel, you know, it makes sense.
Wait a minute, I have a question about this model. So they squat on these patents then. They don't actively try to sell them to companies that they think will implement them?
Well, this is an interesting part of the story. I think the most interesting part of this story that is poorly understood by the public, which is that one of the things they do with these patents. So first of all, in order to buy patents, they need money, even though Nathan Myhrvold, who's behind Intellectual Ventures, has tons of money. They need money to buy these patents. So they get investors. And in this case, Microsoft and Sony are two of their biggest investors this time around. In the past, Apple and Intel have also been investors when they raise money in order to buy new patents. And then part of the reward for investing is they get some of these patents on the cheap. So they get from Intellectual Ventures, they either get to use those patents or they get a percentage of the royalties or the revenue from the patents when there's lawsuits or whatever. And in most of the cases, it's not a case where Intellectual Ventures will go after a company and that company they go after is like, no, that's our intellectual property. We're going to do you. In almost every case, they think, well, it's not worth it to have a big court case. So here, we'll just throw a few million dollars at you and just go away. And that's essentially the business model. It's a combination of raising money and then disseminating as if the patent ownership itself is the product that is then monetized.
Right.
So it's really a nasty state of affairs. One of the things interesting about this is that these organizations seem so shady. For example, one of the ways that that Intellectual Ventures deals with its status as a patent troll is that it creates thousands of shell companies and then just distributes these old patents to these companies. So it's like this kind of really shady operation. The smaller ones seem even shadier. You can't sometimes some of these companies you can't even find the company. You go to the address that they list on their documentation, and it's just it's either of somebody's house or it's like, a P.O. box or whatever. So
right.
it's a shady business and just weird.
And where do you think they pick up these patents? Is it like they have scouts, like a baseball scout that run around trying to pick them up?
Intellectual Ventures.
They don't have investors, right?
Well, intellectual ventures would claim that they are like a talent scout, that they go around and find inventors and that they provide a service because they monetize invention. They essentially pay inventors to invent things. The problem with that argument is that then they, by taking them out of circulation, they probably reduce the chance that an invention will actually become a product or a service, because essentially it becomes the stuff of lawsuits and things like that. However, they claim to be monetizing and funding invention because inventors could then make a living when they go around and buy it. They also buy old companies, companies going out of business. It's kind of a parasitic process to a certain extent. They're looking for companies that are on the ropes that where they can get patents very cheaply, and they buy patents by the tens of thousands or even by the millions. They buy huge numbers of patents. And this is all possible because the patent system is such a colossal mess. You can, in terms of software, which is where the patent trolls really, you know, they really target their efforts, it's a ripe industry to go after because the laws are so vague about software. They were essentially created in the 70s when software was not considered a legitimate source of intellectual property. They thought that the hardware computer is what it's all about in the software. Well, that's just a bunch of code that nobody understands. And so the laws are all based on that. Right now, Congress is working on a new law that they hope will improve things. It probably won't fix anything. It's called the Innovation Act. Congress has passed laws before and hasn't really gotten significantly better. But this is really an interesting turn of events, I think, that Apple and Intel this time around are opting out.
Right, but Microsoft and Sony are still A-OK with this system, which is just so funny because it seems like a perversion of a law that was designed to protect inventors. But really, it says someone else can then get in the middle of your invention and the money that it's worth on the marketplace, and you only get the difference between what they're going to get and what you get. So, I'm not really feeling great about middlemen business model in general, having just finished that Michael Lewis book, Flash Boys. So hopefully, I don't know, it's not that I'm all that optimistic that the government can change it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what do you think that this says about Apple and Intel's attitude about this? They think they can either come up with their own patents internally or they can find their own talent.
Well, the problem is that, especially in the smartphone industry, there are so many different inventions inside every smartphone. The more complicated devices and software services and things get, the more potential patent violations are in everything. So every company in this industry essentially has to arm itself with as many patents as it can, just in case someday somebody sues them, they can say, oh, look, they can reach into the bag and pull one out and say, look, we have a patent on this. It's really a kind of a phony baloney process. The patents don't mean, in most cases, what they're supposed to mean, which is a patent is supposed to be an invention that is intellectual property that somebody invented, you know, on their own that they then use in a product. That whole concept is completely gone in the software. Well, not completely gone. It's mostly gone in the software industry. I will say that I'm not entirely surprised that Microsoft and Sony are getting in bed with intellectual ventures. Nathan Myhrvold is a former Microsoft executive. He's well regarded within the company. He's a good friend of Bill Gates. He used to date Martha Stewart. He's a really interesting guy. He has a really expensive book about cooking and technology and stuff like that. He's a fascinating person, and he's completely shameless about the patent trolling thing and really believes, he really drinks the Kool-Aid about patent trolling being a service and a good thing for the world. He makes some good points, but for the most part, he is just the world's biggest patent troll. I think it's a problem. Sony, on the other hand, is good at inventing things. I mean, this is a very innovative company. They're just not good at making products that people can afford and that are exactly what the market is looking for. They have their own internal political problems that prevent them from really succeeding to the extent that their inventions and their intellectual property and their research would suggest that they would succeed. So they want to get in on as many patents as they can. But I think, you know, Sony's in trouble, and I can see them just, you know, clinging to whatever sort of monetization scheme they can get.
Right. Remember, and for those of us who want to see innovation, it becomes very frustrating that patents are kind of the shrapnel with which these wars are fought.
Yeah, exactly. And remember that Sony's biggest source of revenue is selling insurance. A lot of people don't know that. They really don't make a lot of money with their technology. Mm-hmm. Well, in a second, we're going to talk about some trouble that Twitter's having getting users to be more engaging. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace, which is the most awesome, the number one site for creating a website. all your own. If you want to create a website for your business, for whatever it is you want to create a website for, Squarespace is the only place you should consider, and they're our sponsor today. I've been using Squarespace for a couple of years now. I keep saying a couple of years. It's probably like 2.5 years. I've been using them for a long time. I've seen them evolve. They've always been a completely top-notch organization, but right now their templates just keep getting better. So if you're going to build a Squarespace website, the easiest way to do it is to select one of their 25 beautiful templates, and then you can go in and modify those templates to customize exactly what you're looking for. They don't restrict you in terms of what kind of pages you can create. And if you're a developer, of course, they have all the tools to go in there and actually do hardcore development. If you're not a developer, if you don't know anything about building a website, Squarespace is the most perfect place for you to go because it's so easy to use. If you do have a question or do have trouble anywhere along the line, their tech support is open 24/7, and it's excellent. They have e-commerce available for all subscription levels. That means you can sell things on your website, or you can take money for your nonprofit or your school fund drive or whatever it is you need to raise money for. Super easy to do, and it all starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. Squarespace is mobile ready. So it starts, so they have a metric app for iPhone and iPad that lets you check site stats. They also have a blog app that lets you manage your blog on the go from a mobile device. And of course, hosting is included. Squarespace creates incredibly robust websites. So if you suddenly have the runaway hit of the decade, your site will not crash. It will not go down because Squarespace throws all the resources necessary at that site. So start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT, and that'll get you 10% off. And it'll also show your support for Tech News Today, and we appreciate that. We thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today, and remember that a better web awaits, and it all starts with your Squarespace website. Well, Twitter is having trouble getting some users to tweet. A new report from TwopCharts says 44% of Twitter accounts have never sent a single tweet. With us to explain Twitter's problems here is Garrett Sloan, who is a writer for Adweek. Welcome, Garrett.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Now, Twitter gets a lot of new signups. I believe, if memory serves, they've actually had 1.5 billion people signing up. But many of these are either canceled by Twitter or they aren't real accounts for one reason or another. Why is that? Why are so many Twitter accounts essentially invalid?
Well, obviously Twitter has a spam problem. It's an easy way to just sign up, and marketers or spammers really are just looking to get as many signups as they can, get followers, and just start blasting out tweets to people. So clearly, it's a way for very easy sign-up process. It's not always tied to a true identity. So these kind of accounts. Sorry, am I breaking up a little bit?
But you're okay.
Forgive you for that.
We hear you.
Forgive me for that. Okay, good. So yeah, they're getting all these sign-ups, and that's 1.5 billion sort of spam type signups that sort of plague the system, and they weed them out till they only have about 240 million active users a month, or 250 million now according to TwopCharts.
Now, how does Twitter define an active user? Their definition allows for some people that I wouldn't think are particularly active. So what is the definition there?
I think Twitter is saying that anybody who comes to the platform to even look at tweets once a month would be a monthly active user. I don't know exactly the metric, but that's pretty close to it. I think if you're come once a month, view a few tweets, you'll be a monthly active user.
That's pretty astonishing, don't you think? I mean, if they're counting lots and lots of people who have never sent a tweet as active users.
They're just lurkers.
Yes. Lurkers. Yeah, that's if you go to Twitter and you want to just read the tweets and you're not actual participant, then they will count that. TwopCharts did give statistics on what they see there too. They said, 129 million people come monthly, do not tweet at all, and 126 million at least tweet once a month. So more are people who aren't tweeting. According to TwopCharts.
Sorry. How do these statistics compare with when Twitter was only for the geeks? Do we have any idea? Because in the early 2000s, well, I guess 2006, 2007, when Twitter launched and it was mostly just geeks using it, it seems like the people who were on it were actually talking. But now you see it on the news, you see it on the sides of billboards. So it's everywhere and it's part of pop culture. So do you think that that changes the way people use it?
I think so. I think you're touching on something that Twitter is hoping everyone catches on to, which is makes it what they call the second screen. It's what you go to when you're watching the news and you hear the hashtag and you have to go converse about that topic or watching American Idol. These are what Twitter would like to be the second screen factor for its business, and that's what it's becoming. It's a media platform that people do go to just to consume news or watch media sound bites, and that's sort of the behavior now. So I don't know the historical difference between when it first started and if it was more people conversing as actual Twitter users, but I think it is more now just a media platform in a lot of ways.
Now, Garrett, you write for Adweek, of course. So what is this news like this? I know there's all kinds of news that comes out from different companies that indicate a similar phenomenon, that the Twitter isn't that active. How does that affect them as an advertising platform?
I think there's still a lot of growing up to do and explaining to advertisers. Twitter is doing a really good job of pitching to advertisers who are excited to just try these new types of ad products. It's launching new ad products all the time. It says it's more performance driven now. You can get tweets that say download this app right now, or tweets that will allow you pretty soon to just call the business that sent the tweet. That's sort of an evolution from where the branded tweets were sort of building brand awareness. It's more performance driven now. I think this whole concept is attracting advertisers and they're interested, but I think it needs to now be backed up with metrics and numbers and showing that it will drive sales, showing that it does drive brand awareness, and show that people actually are on the platform, not just fake accounts, which is a big problem.
Well, Garrett, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today and explaining these numbers. It's quite an interesting phenomenon. Personally, I think that Twitter specializes in influential people with megaphones talking to the public and also talking to each other. And so if the majority isn't especially engaged, it's probably not the end of the world for Twitter. They do have probably the most influential audience, even if it's smaller than it appears. But in any event, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today.
No, thanks for having me, and hopefully we'll do it again.
All right. You can find Garrett at adweek.com and on Twitter at Garrett Sloan. I'm going to spell that GarrettSloane.
That's right.
All right. Take care. Well, Amazon is getting into the comic book business. The company announced yesterday that it's buying Comixology, which is a digital comics app. In fact, the number one digital comics app. With us to tell us about this story is Albert Ching, who's senior editor for Comic Book Resources. Welcome, Albert.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing great. Albert is Skyping in on the audio only.
Nope, I got video.
Oh, you do have video. Great. There you are. You in the flesh.
Just
wonderful.
Got it.
Well, so Albert, what does the digital comic book loving community think about this acquisition?
Well, I think, you know, it's sort of a wait and see at this point. You know, I mean, I'll be honest, comic book fans tend to be a skeptical lot. And I think a lot of people, when they hear a large corporation like Amazon getting involved in the digital comics market, which is still in many ways a new and still very growing market, they get skeptical as to what it might mean and whether or not it might have effects that might not be good for the user. But I think overall it's there is optimism, and especially with what the user base that Amazon obviously has might mean to expanding the audience of comic books.
Now, Albert, I don't follow the comic world super closely. Can you give me a sense of how popular digital comic books are compared to on paper or whatever? Has the comic book world really embraced digital yet?
You know, it's hard to assess exactly because digital statistics are still very much kept under wraps by publishers and distributors. One thing, you know, Comixology has passed certain benchmarks. Last fall, they reported 200 million downloads. But it is still growing, but it's definitely getting popular. Print comics still sell well. But, you know, it is new. Just a few years ago, in like 2011, you couldn't buy most comics day and date digital, which, you know, compared to, say, how, you know, music evolved in the digital space, that seems very late. And so it's still growing. You know, back in like 2010, when the iPad launched, it was mostly archival content, older comics that you could get digitally. And now only in the last couple of years has it been sort of the full slate for virtually every major publisher that is available when people want them, when they come out.
What do you think the independent comic publishers think of this? Do you think that they are going to continue to be embraced by Amazon? Because Kindle does a pretty good job of embracing self-publishing for just regular books. Do you think that will translate to comics?
I think so. I think the hope is just to continue to break down walls for people. You know, the convenient thing about digital comics is that, you know, the reality is there's not necessarily that many comic book stores and that many places that you can buy single issue comics and a lot of independent comics these days. You know, maybe, you know, Barnes and Noble will have the, you know, Marvel and DC collected editions in their stores. But, you know, for independent publishers, I think it's definitely going to be seen as positive. Hopefully, we don't know how everything's going to shake out, but it is, you know, has the effect of making these things more accessible to people who might not necessarily have all those options before.
Now, just to give everyone a sense of how huge Comixology is on the iPad platform, my understanding is that if you exclude games, it's the number one top grossing app on the iPad. It's that huge. Now, Albert, what do you think of Comixology's self-publishing platform for, you know, from a qualitative standpoint? Is this a good way for comic creators to self-publish?
Yeah, no, I've definitely seen people have success with it. And, you know, there's a very obvious fact that, you know, self-publishing straight to digital cuts down some cost. You know, you don't have the printing cost associated with that. And, you know, since Comixology does have such a wide user base at this point and potentially even wider after this acquisition, it definitely opens things up to a potential audience that could be very big without doing things on your own, rather than doing things on your own.
Now, Comixology has technology called Guided View. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, basically, I think the main thought behind it is, you know, the average iPad screen, certainly or tablet screen, or certainly a phone screen, is smaller than a comic book page. And, you know, some of the words and the speech bubbles and such get a little compressed. And with Guided View, you can kind of view panel by panel. It's not quite animated, but it segues nicely between each panel. And then you really can get a good look at the art. And that's a, you know, very high quality image of the detail of art. And also it makes the reading experience a little easier for some people than just looking at the whole page all at once.
All right, Albert.
So obviously this will be great for the Kindle Fire line. Is there any potential in any of the Paperwhite Kindles for comics, maybe to have a renaissance of the old world way, maybe?
You know, I think that is definitely possible. I think a lot of that stuff remains to be seen. You know, I talked with David Steinberger at Comixology and David Nagar at Amazon just yesterday. And, you know, it seems like even they are figuring out a lot of how these integrations might work out and what might be possible. But, yeah, I think what you're saying is certainly a possibility.
Well, Albert, I want to thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, of course. Thanks so much.
You can find Albert at comicbookresources.com and on Twitter at AlbertXII. Well, an internal Samsung report appears to show that Samsung lied to the public, press, and shareholders about how many Galaxy Tab devices it sold in 2011. Now, Natalie, this is a disturbing part of a disturbing trend, in my opinion. Samsung seems to get caught quite a bit being less than honest about various things. Let me just very quickly, before I get your reaction to this, I want to go through some of the history here. In early January 2011, a report from Strategy Analytics found that Samsung's, well, this is this case, in fact, that we're talking about, that their sales in 2011 were about 1 million units for the whole year. But Samsung, in fact, early in January said that they had already sold 2 million units. So that's the case in question. Now, the history is that Samsung was fined $340,000 by Taiwan's Fair Trade Commission for astroturfing. That's where they apparently hired a bunch of people to pretend to be fans of Samsung to go around into message boards and say nice things about Samsung. They were caught cheating on benchmark tests and then lying about it in a couple of cases. For example, they had a special high-power CPU mode. When they detected a benchmark, they'd kick into this special mode. They denied it. It was proved that existed, and then later on they removed it and sort of came clean on that one. They've also been fined by Taiwan's FTC for lying in ads about smartphone features. So, you know, they have a bad reputation at the very least. You never know how, you know, where these things come from. You never know how much control the company has centrally over the little tweaks that their engineers do in the hardware, or what a sort of a third party kind of marketing company that they might hire or be trying out might do in advertising and so on. However, they do have this reputation, and this isn't going to help at all.
No.
Do you think that the Samsung fan community out there cares about these types of issues?
Well, it depends which community we're talking about, because Samsung does now have a good contingency of fanboys that, you know, may excuse this or look the other way because they love their gadgets so much. But, you know, you don't want to develop a reputation for lying, especially not with legislators, especially not with your shareholders. And the lie in question that we're talking about now is that they said that they had shipped 2 million Galaxy Tabs, reducing Apple's market share from 75% to 95% in just less than 6 weeks, which is so unbelievable. But, you know, a lot of news outlets went to press with it. And I mean, what does that get you? You know, it gains some momentum, but then when you're caught, it looks so bad.
Yeah. And in fairness, this is an accusation. It appears to be a smoking gun that Apple has presented in court. And we haven't really heard the official Samsung response to this. It also needs to be said that whenever Apple and Samsung go to battle in court, part of the strategy is to kind of sully the reputation of the other company, and it
right.
happens in both directions. Samsung in past cases has dug up, you know, Steve Jobs emails that are very damning of Apple and their sort of business practices. So this isn't a pile on Samsung story. This is more of a, like, you know, this Samsung has this PR problem. They may have a corporate governance problem, and these patent cases bring up all the mud and dirt, and this is the latest example of that.
Right. And I don't like the way this Fortune story tells it. Like, we knew this wasn't true. Yeah. Look at all these outlets who published it, but we didn't. We know everything.
I understand that, though. That's something that columnists end up doing, because columnists are always saying things. And when I'm a columnist myself, and we say something and predict something that's accurate, you know,
right.
we're universally ignored or dismissed.
Oh, everyone likes to say,
criticized.
I told you so. I know. I got
yeah.
that. It just looks a tiny bit obnoxious.
Yeah, it is a tiny bit obnoxious, but I personally love saying it. So you're supposed to say, I hate to say, etc., but I love it. All right, well, let's move to the next problem, the next story. Sony is contacting 25,000 owners of its VioFit 11A laptop and telling them to stop using it. The reason is that the laptops could catch fire because of the batteries inside that were actually built by Panasonic. In other news, Natalie, Sony sold only 25,000 of these units. That's a shockingly
yeah.
low number. But anyway, back to
I have one of these VioFits, actually.
Do you really?
I do. Not this exact same model, but the same. It's the same line where the screen flips up and becomes a tablet. And I had noticed just 2 weeks ago, it stopped working altogether. The battery just went completely dead. It wouldn't take a charge. It wouldn't turn on. It just died altogether. So I have to think it's part of this same problem.
Yeah, probably is.
At least it didn't blow up on me.
Yeah, there's that. There's always something to be grateful for. Well, you know, this is an interesting story, in my opinion, because this sort of thing used to happen a lot more frequently. Remember when Dell laptops are always catching on fire on airplanes and things like that?
And Nokia phones.
Nokia phones,
too.
Especially
with the counterfeit batteries.
Well, that's really where, in recent years, the battery industry has gotten a lot better at making safer batteries. But most of the, you know, phone exploding and laptops catching on fire stories have been about counterfeit batteries made in sweatshops in China and elsewhere. And this is Panasonic, you know, so this is a These are two, you know, premier Japanese brands that are selling laptops that catch on fire. So this is not a good thing. It also needs to be said that Lenovo recalled 150,000 ThinkPad battery packs recently over similar issues. And by the way, Sony is getting out of this business. They're selling its PC division to Japan Industrial Partners, which is an investment fund. So soon enough, Sony will not be selling laptops. So
but they still have to pay for a mistake for a division that they're not going to profit from. So that hurts.
They certainly do. Well, Facebook wants to improve the quality of news feeds by punishing posts that contain what they call like bait. Like bait is when you post something, you post cat photos and say, hey, everybody like this, because you want to have a viral hit on your hands. And this is really, I think this is an interesting story because Facebook and Google and other companies are really working hard to try to make their feeds, which are littered with garbage, really garbage content, and you know, spammy, link baity sort of content, and they want to have take the high road. They want to have highfalutin content from the New Yorker, where you know it's like intellectual information and so on. But it's an interesting question. You know, Matthew Ingram raised a very interesting question on GigaOm today around this story, which is that, you know, who is Facebook to say what's good content and what isn't? The reason like bait type content, the reason link bait type content as well is popular is because people like this stuff. People like cat photos. People like unicorn photos and like cheesy, you know, they like that stuff. The public genuinely likes that stuff. So, you know, I don't know what your feeling is, but do you think that Facebook should be in the business of using its algorithms to favor content that it thinks is good content and to smack down content it thinks is trash content?
Right. It's just basically them telling you don't be a goofball, which you can, I guess, have a goofball algorithm. It's just pretty ridiculous because they're not being put there by bots. They're being put there by people who just want to get your attention. You know, there are people like that in the schoolyard. It's so silly.
Yeah, it is. It is genuinely silly. And, you know, when people are persuaded to click like on something, they do so voluntarily. And, you know, there's something to be said for the objectivity of popularity as a metric for quality. You know, that's what democracy is based on in any event. Well, it's interesting that they're trying to do this. We'll see if they succeed.
I'm all for telling people not to be a goofball, but you do have the right to be a goofball.
That's right. Absolutely. Well, a plethora of news reports were published yesterday under a headline saying that France had banned the sending of emails after 6 p.m. It's a fantastic story. The problem is that it isn't true. It all started with an error-filled blog post on the Guardian newspaper website Wednesday saying that unions and employers signed a legally binding agreement requiring staff to turn off their phones after 6 p.m. The Guardian said the deal affected a million French employees. Here's what the Guardian got wrong. The agreement didn't say anything about a 6 p.m. cutoff. The Guardian made that up. It contained vague language about a, quote, obligation to disconnect, unquote, from independent contractors, not employees, after hours. These contractors have flexible hours and aren't limited to France's 35-hour workweek laws, which also ban employees from working more than 10 hours per day. So the agreement was designed to protect these contractors from being taken advantage of. French law allows companies to demand 13-hour days from contractors, but not more than 13 hours. And the other part that they got wrong is that this affects only about 250,000 contract workers and is essentially unenforceable anyway. Germany has similar guidelines. This is nothing unusual in Europe. One irony is that the press repeating the Guardian's errors implied the French are lazy, but it was the reporters themselves who were being lazy. Another irony is that the Guardian blog is called the Shortcuts blog. Sounds like they took some shortcuts with their reporting. So, Natalie, don't you hate this kind of thing? One bad article, everybody picks up on the bad article, and pretty soon it becomes true because everybody's repeating it.
Right, and it sort of speaks to our personal beliefs that we are a little too obsessive and this is the way it should be. Maybe we think that, but that's not necessarily the case. I think there are some efforts to do this in Brazil as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something like this.
That's right. That's right. So we try to do our part to set the record straight on these stories. And there are some other articles coming out today, all day probably, setting the record straight as well. The French media is up in arms about this because clearly this is based on a British and probably to a certain extent American kind of historical bias against French culture. And so, the French media is really making a big deal about this, as they should. Well, Natalie, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today this week. It's been a fantastic week. You've been our guest co-anchor all week, and we love having you on.
Oh, I like doing it. So thanks for the invitation.
All right.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Hope to have you back again soon.
You'll see me around.
All right. Well, do you like breaking news? Follow Twit's breaking news feed on Twitter. It's Twit News. Makes a lot of sense. Join our Google Plus community and also circle our page by searching for Tech News Today on Google Plus. And also, we want to hear from you. Tell us what's on your mind. Give us some news tips. You can email us at tnt@twit.tv or leave us voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. Also, don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight. And that's tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific and every weeknight. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.